It's always seemed to me that what feels right is really kind of what I should do, and if it feels bad, I shouldn't do it. Or if what I do makes somebody experience pain, then that's kind of a marker that says I better back off and not do what I'm doing. But you know what? I don't think those things are true. I think sometimes when I feel bad about something, it still might be right to do. Or if my actions may be painful for somebody else to experience, it still might be right. Those are important questions to explore. Left unexplored, I think that we're left to the possibility of spiritual and emotional unhealth.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
You know, Jack, there are so many times in my life when it's felt so right to do what I ultimately found out was so wrong. It's such a paradox in my life. Mm-hmm. And looking at your life, do you see that ever?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or oftentimes for me, it was the opposite, that something was so permissible that seemed so impermissible to me. That's another one.
So what we're both saying is that according to our culture's way of defining conscience, which if I feel a particular way, it's kind of felt right or wrong to do it according to my conscience. And that's kind of the direction we want to go in today, is look a little bit more about our conscience. We started talking about it last week and just thought it was a important enough topic for us to maybe try and continue with it today. I have an example out of my life, Jack, that just comes to mind with my... It felt so right to do something that was so wrong. My husband and I got married when I was just a few weeks away from being 24. And when, within a year after that, he had finished his training to be a pastor, and we went to a very small town in California, and he began doing the pastorate at a small church. There was probably 100 people there. Immediately, it became obvious to me that the church was in a lot of pain. A lot of things were kind of unraveling. And what I did was set my mind to sew up all the loose holes as best I could. I became the one man, one lady Christian education director, and I kind of did everything with the kids. I taught every Sunday. I put together the whole lesson plan and everything, and spent, you know, a lot of time with the kids. I did activities for the kids. I really worked because that part of the whole program just wasn't happening at all. I saw a lot of people hurting, and so I went out to lunch with people. I took meals to them. I just spent my days knocking myself out to what I thought was to serve these people. I thought that it was really right, that it was really loving, and I felt bad if I didn't do those things. Spent a great deal of our income having people over. It was probably five, if not six nights out of the week, we would have people over every day. We just constantly had people coming in and out of our house. Our house was very open. You can see I just bent over backwards, literally, to try and do what I thought, what I felt was right. But looking back on it, Jack, what I came to realize, and it was a very painful recognition, was that I wasn't loving these people. I was trying to avoid what I was afraid of. I was trying to avoid failure. I didn't want to look bad. I didn't want to look wrong. I didn't want to have this ministry that my husband and I were trying to make happen. I didn't want it to fall apart. Well, I had to eventually see that what was underneath my efforts, because the church did in fact fall apart. And I found that I was absolutely devastated by that. I hadn't been loving these people. What I had been doing was being an idolater, avoiding my fear. And I can't say that that's 100% true. There were certainly times that people that I cared about and wanted to love, but not to the extent that I was doing it. It had succumbed my life.
So what it illustrates is how our perception of my own actions, how I describe my own actions, how I interpret my own actions, can be so very different from what's actually going on, what is in fact objectively the reality, the true description of my actions. Yeah.
And I thought my conscience was telling me that that was the right thing to do. And I think that my conscience was misinformed. It wasn't based on the truth of how to love people. It was based on my fear of what would happen if I didn't do what I was doing.
So you actually would have felt guilty had you curtailed your activity in some way and cut back on how many times you were having people over for dinner and so on.
I don't know if I would have. I don't think that's my bent, to feel so guilty. But my bent is that I would have felt wrong.
Okay, right.
I would have felt like I wasn't doing the right thing. And I think that really would have come from I was afraid of what would happen if I didn't.
And what's the distinction you're making between feeling guilty and feeling wrong?
I just wouldn't have used that language.
Okay.
It just felt very right to do this. I was really justifying it by thinking that it was a loving thing to do, when the reality is it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm making the distinction between I thought I was doing something wrong, or I would have felt like I was doing something wrong, rather than feeling guilty, because I work with so many people who talk about this heavy weight of guilt that just seems like it's dripping with
shame.
Shame. That's it. That's what I'm looking for. And I don't think I had the component of shame.
Okay.
It was more the component of fear.
Okay. I can think back on a number of examples of my life where that component of shame was a big part of it, and the avoidance of shame was a very important motive for me. I think I've already used the example in the past of having grown up in a culture that just saw alcohol as inherently evil, that the first time that I went away to college and I sat under a Bible teacher, and over the course of time I became persuaded from the scriptures themselves that alcohol wasn't inherently evil, that it was the abuse of alcohol that was immoral, was a sin, but that alcohol as such was not inherently evil. But while I became persuaded of that in my mind, I had not retrained those feelings, those feelings of shame would come from. And I think I've described this in the past on this program, being invited over to a professor's house for dinner, and he kind of offered me some sherry, not only offered me some sherry, kind of demanded that I take it, because he was testing me to see what sort of Christian I was going to be.
This is a different professor than the one that taught you about alcohol.
Right, yeah. It was just a pastor, Bible teacher, that persuaded me of... Well, I shouldn't say he had persuaded me. It's not like he set out to to teach me the virtues of alcohol. It's just that he taught me a view of the faith that was so different than the one I had had before. And I came to see that it wasn't about not drinking, that, mm-hmm. that my greatest confession in life was not that I don't drink.
Wouldn't that be easy, Jack, if we just didn't have to drink
exactly.
and make it okay? Yeah.
So I remember just the literal pounding of my head, you know, the racing of my heart, the pounding in my head, this almost tangible voice saying, Jack, you fool, you're going to make yourself so unclean if you let alcohol touch your lips. But I felt convinced in my own head that a believer was free to drink alcohol if there was some good reason for it. So I went ahead and drank all the time, the voice just shouting at me inside. But I was able, you know, I had the strength of convictions to be able to say, shut up, Jack. Shut up, voices that are distorting the truth. And they shut up. You know, they drowned out. But I had to make a deliberate choice to violate that conscience, to go against everything in me that felt so wrong in doing what I was about to do.
To really go against those very loud shouts, those very loud voices.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, Jack, those voices can be so loud, they can just be absolutely deafening.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think about people that I work with, for example, who... Am I interrupting or can I go there?
No, that's great, yeah.
I think of people who have been, for example, sexually abused. And there is a big imperative with a lot of the people who have been sexually abused that says, don't talk. This is a secret. If you talk about it, I'll kill you. I'll hurt you. You'll be the one that gets in trouble. Nobody will believe you. A whole lot of different reasons why people are believing they shouldn't talk or have been told they shouldn't talk. And so they literally sew their mouths up regarding this for years and years. When they become to counseling and they begin talking about this, the voices are absolutely enormous. They're shouting. They're deafening. Where it's hard to hear anything but, you're bad, you're wrong, you're in trouble, you're going to get hurt, you're going to die. Even when the abuser might be dead, that they really don't have any tangible power on this earth. But nonetheless, this person's mind has been so trained to believe what's not the truth. What used to be the truth. Perhaps if they did tell it one time, it would have had enormous consequences. But now, as an adult, even with the abuser dead, it doesn't have those kind of consequences. But they feel so wrong, so bad, and even like a betrayer of their abuser to say anything. So their conscience is saying, don't talk. When in reality, what's really important for them to do in order to heal, to work at what's the truth, is to say things out loud. Just like your being able to drink was something that you needed to be able to say, it really is okay in certain contexts, in certain ways. It really is okay for a person to start talking about their abuse in certain contexts, in certain ways.
Right. And I think the point that we want to stress is how right it can be to violate that conscience defined in that way, that when we define the conscience as those feelings that have been programmed into us by whatever has programmed those feelings into us, feelings of false guilt, feelings of false shame, distorted sense of what is blameworthy and what is not blameworthy, that needs to be violated. And it's an important point to make, because we have been trained not to violate our conscience, which in one sense is true if we rightly define what the conscience is. If the conscience is what it is God has taught me, what I understand God to be teaching me about reality, I shouldn't violate that. That's true. But that's conscience in the biblical sense. This other sense of conscience, where it's those inner voices, those inner feelings that we want to be our guide, sometimes those need to be violated, and I'm wrong not to violate that conscience. I'm actually going against what's good and right and true to not violate it.
Yeah, and we often think of the word violation as always being wrong, and I said that's kind of a hard word to use here. But going against what we have always believed is right, but really is wrong.
Right.
And just to kind of review from last week when we were talking about conscience, you were making a very important distinction between the conscience as we typically think of it in our culture today and what the Bible is calling conscience. And I think what we think of it today is what you just described, a feeling, underlying the word feeling, of regret, remorse, shame, guilt. It's false shame, it's false guilt, it's false regret, it's false betrayal, but nonetheless we really feel like it's right.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what the Bible says is conscience, which is, I think you said it's with knowledge of the truth. And it's a cognitive process, it's a reasonable, it's coming from our reason, it's coming from our thinking mode, not from what feels right to me, but based on reality that's described in the scripture.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that's what the New Testament writers mean by conscience, is that cognitive-based understanding of what God says is true, what God says is real. What God says is blameworthy is blameworthy. What God says is right is right. What God says is good is good. and to have my mind conform to that is to have a sound conscience. They use conscience probably more like we tend to use consciousness. Consciousness might even be a better translation in some cases, because it's a consciousness of the truth of God, a consciousness of reality as God defines it, is a sound conscience, a clear conscience.
And I need to add, too, that if we have a conscience that's only based on our feelings and an erroneous understanding of our feelings, a false understanding, to the extent that we have that, we're not healthy. We're not psychologically or emotionally healthy or spiritually healthy.
That's right.
So our psychological and spiritual health is bound up in a false conscience. Our psychological and spiritual health is very much bound up on a objective reality, truth-based understanding.
Right, exactly. And the process of my sanctification is in part the process of retraining those feelings, retraining those emotional indicators that can be grounded in a false conscience rather than a true conscience.
Emotional indicators, emotional reactions a lot of times.
Reactions, yeah.
That just come out of our gut, come out of our experience, have become who is me, mm-hmm. who I am. And so lots of times I have to retrain all of me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big endeavor to really come and see what's true and right.
Right.
Now, Jack, I think there are people in the Bible who you mentioned earlier who did violate their conscience in the way we're talking about,
right,
in order to pursue what's right. Can
right.
we go to some of those examples?
Yeah, this is, let me read a passage here. This is a little lengthy, but I think to get the whole picture, it would be helpful to be reminded of this story. This is Peter, the Apostle Peter. We're going to start off first with a Gentile named Cornelius. I'm reading in the 10th chapter of Acts. Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, so he was a Roman, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. By saying he feared God, he's a certain class of Gentiles who'd become so disenchanted with the empty paganism of the Roman culture that he'd become attracted to Judaism and in all likelihood went to the synagogue every Sabbath day and heard the reading of scriptures and actually became a student of the Hebrew scriptures. Even though he hadn't actually converted to Judaism and become a Jew, he was nonetheless a real active student of the Jewish religion and the Jewish scriptures.
Even to the extent that he invested in it financially.
Exactly, yeah, supported it financially. And that's out of a true spirituality is what is being suggested here by Luke, in the case of Cornelius at least. It's not just an, you know, kind of idle intellectual curiosity. He doesn't have anything better to do. It's because he has a heart that really yearns to know the God who's there, and he's identified that God as the God of the Bible and has become a student for that reason. It says, about the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come in and said to him, Cornelius. And fixing his gaze on him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, sir, or Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. Now dispatch some men to Joppa and send for a man named Simon, who is also called Peter. He is staying with a tanner named Simon, whose house is by the sea. When the angel who was speaking to him had left, he summoned two of his servants and a devout soldier of those who were his personal attendants, and after he had explained everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. On the next day, as they were on their way and approaching the city, Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. But he became hungry and was desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance, and he saw the sky opened up and an object like a great sheet coming down, lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals and crawling creatures of the earth and birds of the air. A voice came to him, Get up, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy and unclean. Again a voice came to him a second time, What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy. This happened three times, and immediately the object was taken up into the sky. Now while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind as to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, the men who had been sent by Cornelius having asked directions for Simon's house, appeared at the gate, and calling out, they were asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. While Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men are looking for you. But get up, go downstairs, and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself." Peter went down to the men and said, "Behold, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for which you have come?" They said, "Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews, was divinely directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and hear a message from you." So he invited them in and gave them lodging. And on the next day he got up and went away with them, and some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him. On the following day he entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, "Stand up, I too am just a man." As he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him, and yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That is why I came without even raising any objection when I was sent for. So I ask for what reason you have sent for me." And then the passage goes on, but I think that's enough to make the points that we want to make here. Two points in this passage, Peter is asked to violate his conscience by God. His conscience in the sense that we typically think of a conscience, my feelings of impropriety, my feelings of what's blameworthy. And as God is saying, I want you to do what you feel would be blameworthy here. In the first case, it's in the vision, the dream, the trance that he has, where God lures these animals down from heaven. And if you remember the Old Testament law, there are two kinds of animals. Some are prescribed as being clean, and some are prescribed as being unclean. And what the law means by that is, it is permissible, according to the Mosaic law, for you to kill and eat these animals that are designated clean, but any animal that is designated unclean, it is unlawful for you to kill and eat that animal. Well, this sheet being lowered down from heaven is full of animals that were defined by the law as unclean animals, which means any good Jew who's going to keep the Mosaic covenant is not allowed to kill and eat such an animal. So God fills up the sheet with these animals, lowers it down to earth, and then says of Peter, "I want you to kill them and eat them."
And for him, it would be radically wrong to do that.
Radically wrong, yeah.
Even in the face, even so much so that he's saying, "No, God, I won't do that."
Yeah.
Even though God's telling him to.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's how strongly he feels this, is you've got the God of the universe commanding him, kill and eat, and Peter saying, "Oh no, I've never done that in my entire life. I would never do that to you, God. I would never disobey you in that way." And God is saying, "Peter, this is God, kill and eat." And he does that three times. Peter resists it all three times in response to this vision. But here we have the God of heaven saying, "Peter, I want you to violate your conscience. Peter, I want you to violate your conscience. Peter, I want you to violate your conscience here." It speaks to two issues. One is how powerful our conscience is, because we can have God himself in our face saying, "Here's what I want you to do," and our response is, "Oh, no, I would never do that." So it speaks to the issue of how powerful those voices are on the one hand, but it also speaks to the issue that God sometimes commands us to violate that conscience defined in that way, that voice in me that says, "You better not do that." Now, why would Peter have a conscience that's different from what God wants him to do? Well, because his conscience has been trained by his understanding of the Mosaic covenant. It's been trained by the law that God gave to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. What we learn here, what Peter learns here through this whole experience in time, is that as good and right and valid as the Mosaic covenant is, for what God wanted to accomplish through it and what God wanted to do in the Jewish nation, it's not the whole story about what is and is not right and good for a human being. It just isn't. It has a limited place in God's scheme of things. But as is our tendency, we can be short-sighted enough that we understand what God is requiring of me in one situation, in one context, to be the whole of what requires of any human being anywhere, anytime, any place. That's a very easy mistake to make. And it's a relatively innocent mistake. It would be arrogant of us Gentiles to look at a Jew like Peter at this time and go, oh, you know, what a fool. I mean, he thought that just because God commanded that of the Jews, that applies to every person in every time and every place. Well, what else is he supposed to think? It was the only morality he knew, and it was the only morality that the scriptures had taught him. I mean, he just doesn't have enough information to know that he needs to broaden his horizons. And it shouldn't be surprising to us that he didn't know that he should broaden his horizons. It took God coming and saying, I need to retrain you now. There's more to what I'm up to in this world and this life than you are aware of. And let's begin the retraining process. Let's start by, why don't you take some unclean animals and eat them, Peter? And that was the beginning of a retraining process for him. But it was a retraining process that God needed to take him through. And in order for him to be retrained, God was going to call upon him to literally violate those deep down voices inside that were saying, never do this, Peter. Never, ever, whatever else you do, never eat unkosher food. And God is saying to him directly, Peter, I want you to eat unkosher food now. That was the first occasion. The second occasion is that we have Gentiles show up at his door. Now here, his conscience has been trained by something different, not by the law of God itself, which is right and good and true in its proper context, but by the traditions of the Jews. I don't think that there's anything in the law itself that ever dictated, that ever commanded a Jew to not associate, to not socialize with Gentiles. But it had become the tradition, it had become the habit, it had become the custom of Jews to see it as their religious obligation, as their moral obligation, to just keep themselves apart from Gentiles and never have any real meaningful social association with them.
They would have considered it to be the right choice, the obedient choice, the more spiritual choice.
Exactly.
To stay away from these people.
Exactly. And so that had been Peter's practice his entire life, is to remain socially aloof from Gentiles out of a sense of moral obligation, a spiritual obligation to God. He did so in order to obey his God. Well, now along come some Gentiles who say, an angel from the God of heaven has commanded us to come and fetch you and take you back to talk to our master, our Gentile Roman master. Well, all of a sudden, Peter's in a bind. On the one hand, unless he's going to totally discredit their claim to have been sent by an angel of God, all of his moral scruples tell him, you don't associate with Gentiles, they need to get lost. And yet everything that he believes, has been set up to believe, is the truth of what God is up to in his life, are telling him, okay, go with them, accompany them. And it's to Peter's credit that he not only ends up going with them, but he shows them hospitality. He invites them into his home, which had to be a huge violation of his conscience. Never in his life has he ever had a Gentile walk through the threshold of his door, let alone spend the night there and feed them and show them hospitality. So, like me in that drinking of alcohol, he had to have voices in his head pounding like crazy saying, Peter, what are you doing?
Like,
this
oh,
is a
man.
Huge violation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yet he was willing to do it out of obedience to what he believed was what God was doing in his life and what God had commanded him. I mean, remember, he connects the vision that he had just had about God commanding him to violate his conscience with this occasion that gets literally comes to his doorstep, put on his doorstep, Peter, violate your conscience here. And Peter makes the connection and says, oh, I get it. God was training me that he's going to ask me to violate my conscience, and he wants me to do that here. My son thinks I've made a mistake in interpreting this context. He thinks that God's real message was you're supposed to eat the Gentiles who show up at your doorstep. But I don't think he's right. I think I've got this right.
I sure hope he's got it wrong.
I hope so, too.
That's cute. Okay, so the point is that our conscience can be very strong. In fact, our conscience can be based on right information. It was the law for Peter not to eat these foods, and yet God was saying, nope, we're going to change this plan today, and I want you to go against that, even though it feels bad. And I think that's what often happens. When we're asked to violate our conscience, it will feel bad. And I think we just need to bank on that. It's not going to feel good mm-hmm. when we go against what we've always thought was right. So I think that's what Peter was going against in both instances. What felt bad, what felt wrong, was actually right.
Exactly, exactly. And it takes a certain kind of courage and confidence and a courage of our convictions to do so. But that kind of courage is something that we need to muster, because it's the right and good. It's the wise thing to do, is to follow what I know to be true, even if it feels bad. But too often, our fear and our desire for emotional comfort prevent us from doing the right thing of violating those feelings in order to protect myself emotionally and psychologically. But we need to do the emotionally and psychologically unpleasant and risky thing of going against those voices in order to do the right thing, rather than cave into those voices and protect ourselves emotionally and psychologically. That's the worst thing we could do in a situation like that. That's the wrong thing to do, not the right thing.
You know, I'm thinking of an example in my life. Would it be appropriate to bring it up at this point?
Sure, yeah.
One of the things I learned very strongly in my home, not because it was ever verbally announced that I needed to do this, but nonetheless that I needed to really keep two things. One is I needed to never cause pain in someone else's life. So you make sure you don't say things that might be uncomfortable. You keep your mouth shut. And also that if there's, well, I guess that's it, is that I really shouldn't talk about things that are difficult for other people. I need to keep my mouth shut and back off. Well, I went into the counseling profession, and I could be a really rotten therapist by deciding not to tell people the truth, even when it hurt them. So it's been a really big, and I've brought this up before, issue in my life. Am I going to speak the truth, or am I going to do what's comfortable for me and what feels right to me? What felt right to me, especially in the beginning of my career, was just to shut up, kind of pat people on the back and want them to feel better. Very soon I found out that that was really not loving, that was not right, and I was convinced that I needed to go the other direction. I actually, my pendulum has swung quite far, because now I have a hard time not, maybe I have a difficult time holding back and waiting for timing. That's more difficult for me than not saying. But I still experience, Jack, when I know something's going to be very painful for people, I just think, oh man, here it comes. Oh no. Like I might see indications in people's lives of something that I know may point in a direction of something that they might not want to know or not want to hear about themselves or their experience. And I feel myself cringe inside with the path that I know that they're going down. And if I keep facing them one step upon another, not telling them what I think is maybe true out there, but just kind of facing them as they go along the line, one step after another, and let the story take shape as it is, I cringe, because that's going against what always felt right to me, to not expose what's going on in people's lives, but to kind of keep it hidden. And so I've had to violate my conscience over and over and over again. It's very painful to do that. It's not uncomfortable. It is excruciating sometimes. And here's another piece, is I have this belief in myself, or I have this fear of people's anger. And very often people are angry at me because they don't want to hear the truth about what's going on in their lives, even if they're the ones that are coming to discover it themselves. And so I have to violate what I'm afraid of, and I have to violate my conscience a lot. I've had to. It's become, admittedly, much easier now because I've retrained myself. And I think that's a really hopeful thing that you're saying, is over time, if we do it differently, if we look at the scripture, if we see truly what's loving, we can retrain ourselves to do it differently. But I did go through a very difficult time in figuring out, do I be a good counselor? Do I be a bad counselor? Do I do what's right, or do I do what's wrong in order to please other people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. a good example of that in the New Testament again is you have a passage, you have an event described by Paul in Galatians, in the book of Galatians. He describes a scene where he and Barnabas and some of the other believers who had relocated in Antioch and were teaching in Antioch had become persuaded in their understanding of the gospel and the implications of the gospel as they were working among Gentiles that it was perfectly permissible for them to so identify with the Gentiles that they would associate with them, they'd socialize with them, they would even eat with them. And it's not clear whether that meant they were just eating at the same table with them at the same time, but were themselves eating kosher, or whether they were eating the same menu the Gentiles were, which would include not kosher foods. I suspect it meant the latter. I suspect that they were actually so identifying with the Gentiles that they would sit down and have a ham dinner with them or something where they were not eating kosher. But that's not explicit in his account of the story. Then Peter comes along, and Peter falls into line with the same practice of Paul and Barnabas and the others, and he joins the Gentiles and eats with them as well. Then along come some people that are called the circumcision party. These are Jews who have become believers in Jesus. So they have confessed that Jesus is the Messiah and have become a part of the Christian community in Jerusalem. But these people have a doctrinal position that says you cannot be pleasing to God without being a full-fledged Jew. I mean, it's all fine and good that we have to believe in Jesus. There's no salvation apart from Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Messiah sent into the world to be the Savior of mankind and the Jews and so on. But the way anybody is obedient to God and pleasing to God is by keeping the Mosaic law. And whether you're Jew or Gentile doesn't matter. You have to keep the Mosaic law in order to be pleasing to God. And that's their understanding of things, and they're fully convinced of that. Well, these people of the circumcision party come to visit Antioch as well. And they, of course, would never join the Gentiles to eat, and certainly would not eat unkosher food. So they separate themselves and eat at a separate table and keep isolated from the Gentiles socially. Well, Paul describes how that puts such pressure on Peter that Peter then begins to withdraw and join them at their Jewish table and withdraw from the Gentiles. And that puts so much pressure on the others that the other Jews begin to withdraw from the Gentiles and join Peter and the circumcision party at this other table until finally it's either only Paul and Barnabas are left, depending upon how you read the account, or maybe even Barnabas feels the pressure and departs, and it's Paul alone is the only Jew left here with the Gentiles. And it gets so outrageous that Paul finally stands up and rebukes Peter for his, what he calls, his hypocrisy, not being straightforward about the gospel. I mean, you can almost, when you see the situation described, you can almost feel the feelings that Peter had. You know, he was just fine as long as there wasn't anybody reminding his old conscience about how shameful it is for Jews to associate with Gentiles. As long as he was surrounded by Jews who were able and willing to support him, mm-hmm. in his convictions, that this was really okay. If you have those old voices coming back in the form of these people who don't believe and don't support you in what you're doing, then all of a sudden those old voices begin to get louder and louder and louder again. Peter feels uncomfortable violating those voices, and it's just easier for him to listen to those voices and go back to his old patterns, his old habits. Those voices were stronger than his actual convictions about what was true.
And what's behind those voices? What's behind those voices is that he's afraid of the rejection of those people.
Exactly. And of self-rejection. I mean, of
both.
Of not feeling good about himself.
I am wrong, and they are telling me I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So I better go and just kind of succumb. And I think we've talked about courage before, and that's, at this point, at this place, I really have to have a lot of courage to stand up against where I'm hearing I'm wrong in both regards.
And that's what Paul is telling Peter. That's Paul's rebuke to Peter, is Peter, you're in a situation here where you're listening to voices that are not telling you the full truth. Those voices are not straightforward about the gospel. You have to make a decision here, Peter. Are you going to listen to God, to the scripture, to sound reason, to the revelation that has been brought to us by Jesus about what God is up to in the world and about the fullness of the truth of the gospel? Are you going to listen to that, or are you going to listen to those old, tired voices that have been programmed into you? I'm telling you, Peter, you are disobedient to God if you listen to those old voices and not the fresh truth that Jesus revealed to us. I'm telling you that's wrong. It feels so right to give in to those voices, but in fact it's totally and completely wrong. And that's the thing we have to recognize. There comes a time in our life where we have to say no to all those voices that have been well established within our heads, say no to them, violate them, disobey them, tromp all over those in order to be straightforward about what we know and are convinced is true. Should I go on, or did you want to respond?
As you're talking, I was thinking about something, Jack, and it's just another kind of personal example of this. And it's in our last board meeting for the radio, one of the things that a person said was that when they listen to our program, they really have to work at understanding it. It isn't easy. It's not that we're saying things in a complicated way, but we're saying things that are sometimes intellectually challenging. And as we're talking here about the scriptures, I'm thinking, wow, I wonder if that's happening again. I wonder if people really aren't liking our program because of that. I wonder if we should really kind of water it down some. And that's really kind of a temptation on my part. I'm not really sure how I would do that, because as we're speaking, I'm thinking I'm really trying to make it as clear as I can. I'm trying to ask you questions that I think might clarify. I'm trying to give examples that might be helpful. And yet I think we're still talking at a kind of a different way than maybe a lot of radio programs present, or maybe a lot of stuff that's out there. And I guess I'm a little bit afraid of the lack of interest, or the lack of, or maybe the condemnation that might come from it, or the exposure that comes from it in a way that might be negative. And just thinking, okay, I just have to have courage and do what's before me. And I just have to be who I am. I got hired because I am Christine Barber, who thinks in this way, who talks in this way. They hired me to be me on this program. So to be obedient to what I've been asked to do, I shouldn't water things down. I should be very straightforward. I should speak at the level or in the way that I am, and let that just fall as it falls. And so it's just kind of a little bit of a kind of personal, I think this kind of courage is required of us all the time, not just in really big things like what you were describing here in the scriptures, but just kind of in small, mundane, everyday things. Am I going to be courageous, or am I going to give in, weak-kneed, to what I'm afraid of?
It's analogous to the dilemma that you described that you faced in the counseling. Am I going to make the person, am I going to be nice to the person and support the person in a way that they can feel good about what I've done, or am I going to actually help them by telling them the truth? It's the same dilemma.
Gosh, I'm coming out all over the place, aren't I? I'm consistent.
Yeah. But it's a dilemma that any Bible teacher faces, because as the apostles and the prophets found out, and as Jesus predicted, if you're going to be faithful to me, you're not going to be very well liked, Jesus said. If the world hated me, you can count on the fact that they're going to hate you. And any prophet, and the apostles and the prophets experienced that, and Jesus says, you're in good company if the world persecutes you, if the world hates you, because they hated the prophets before you. It's not fun to be hated and rejected and misunderstood, but it's a necessity in this world that we live in. There will be a tendency for people to criticize you to the extent that you tell them the truth, and to the extent that they are unwilling or not desirous of hearing the truth. That's not going to be popular. But the question that every Bible teacher faces then is, the choice that we face is, what is my agenda here? What is my goal here? In my teaching ministry, do I want to be received? Do I want to be popular? Do I want to be acceptable to people? Do I want to be praised by people? Or do I actually want to love people and serve people by pointing them in the direction of the truth and let the chips fall where they may? Mm-hmm. And that's a very important choice for a Bible teacher to make. In the end, if we go for popularity, we are being unfaithful to our calling. We are being disobedient servants.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jack, it really comes down to that, is in my life, I think I really have wanted, I think if somebody asked me, do I want popularity or do I want power? I think they kind of go together, but I think I'd first say I want popularity. And it's been really a maturing to eventually over time really give up popularity and go for loving people. Mm-hmm. And it's really a big choice to learn how to love people, even at my own risk or at my own not getting what I used to want. But you know what I've found is that I don't really want that anymore. I don't really want what that popularity or that fame or that power in that, I guess. It's just not as important to me. So it's very encouraging to see that over time it is possible to retrain our minds again to want something different, and that that's really the process of sanctification in my life. I really feel like it's such a gift of grace to truly sit with a person and want to love them and see that coming out in the risks that I take, in their being angry at me, in their life being uncomfortable. And indeed, when my clients' lives are uncomfortable, mine is very uncomfortable. If I'm having to deal with somebody going through the agony of self-discovery that they have just been a very selfish person and that that's worked itself out in destroying relationships around them, perhaps for a lifetime, they are going through agony. And it's my job to sit with them in that, not from a distance, but be present with the feeling such that they know I'm with them. So it's at a great cost that I've learned to love people. But I think I've learned it because God gave that gift to me. And that's kind of a real hopeful message that I want to give. We're kind of ending up here today is, you know, it just looks like it's just all, you know, hard work and gosh, is there any benefit to it? And I would say, yes, absolutely. The renewing of my heart and my mind to be a person that really wants to follow God is a reward that's above all rewards. It gives me a otherworldly experience. It gives me a different concept of what life is about. And that's the best of the best. Mm-hmm.
There is a qualification to everything we said today, that there's another sense in which we shouldn't violate the conscience. So maybe next time we can look at Romans 14 and the corresponding passage in 1 Corinthians and deal with that sense in which we shouldn't violate our conscience, what the Bible is teaching us about that.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at Mackenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
We're kind of taking a break in the middle of the program now to talk about the financial needs of Christianity at work. So, Jack, you've been on financial support for how many years in your life?
20 years. Almost 20? 20 years now.
Wow. You yeah. had to stop and think about that.
Yeah.
That's a really long time.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe it's too long now that you think of it.
Yeah.
I think that if I was on financial support for 20 years, I might feel a little bit worn down on the seams. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, I mostly don't think about it. God has been so faithful and has seen us through many a crisis. And I kind of am at a point now where I don't consider my financial situation really any more vulnerable than anybody's paycheck. I mean, anything could happen to anybody, and I'm really not in any different kind of situation. The only difference between me and the typical worker for a wage is that I know how vulnerable my financial situation is. I mean, I'm faced with that monthly. If the money isn't given out of the generosity of my supporters' hearts, then it ain't going to be there. And I'm very keenly aware of that. But God has been so faithful over the years that we haven't got rich, but we haven't gone without. So there's a tremendous amount of security in what God has shown to be his commitment to us.
So, and I guess in answer to my question, are you kind of worn out? Your answer is no.
Well, I guess not, yeah.
You're not sitting on the edge of your seat.
There are times where I literally don't know if I'm going to have an adequate paycheck the next month, where the thought crosses my mind, why do you do this? Why don't you just go out and get a job? But I believe in what I'm doing, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
And how do you apply that to Christianity at work?
How do I apply...
Just your whole perspective of finances and the ongoing program.
What carries over is that I wouldn't want anybody to think that supporting me, or in this case our program, is their responsibility. I've always taken I don't know if I've always taken this attitude, but as I've studied the New Testament, what I've learned is I have to assume responsibility for the financial well-being of myself and my family. So I would take the same attitude toward this program, is that we don't want to twist people's arms and say, you know, you're a bad Christian if you don't support Christianity at work. I really don't believe that. I think people can benefit greatly from this program and have different commitments and make contributions to other places. The issue biblically is just the generosity of spirit, not are you supporting our program. But we would hope that people would see enough value in what we're doing here that they would want to invest in this project by giving us money to buy the airtime.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.